All right, so this one is week 9. Yeah, well, he'll be back in September because I'm going to make him start. But anyway, that's another story. He'll know the ground rules beforehand. God, time, and eternity. Here's week 9. No section of philosophical theology, I think, has received more interest in the past few decades than this controversy over whether or not God is beyond time. And you're going to see some things that parallel the question of time and eternity here. Things like immutability and omniscience especially. So I'm going to put eternity over this line and put time under it. Again, not to embrace anything Kantian, but just to expose that when I interact with the culture today, I know I'm interacting with residue from Kant. That's even a weak way to say it. I'm operating within a Kantian stream that divides things up that way, starting with liberal theology in the 19th century, but definitely expanding into the philosophy of religion in conservative circles today. So, same thing's going to be happening here, just as a clue when we get started. And obviously above that line you'll find also immutability and omniscience. Well, maybe that's an important thing to put here. Immutability, I hope I don't even have to put that above the line. You get that idea. But I hope as we get to the various reasons why people doubt that God can be both timeless and relational, that you'll remember that his knowledge is a faculty of himself prior to creation. In other words, his knowledge is not extra-referential, but self-referential first, before we can conceive of him knowing things, so that we don't reduce his knowing ability to the things outside of himself. That'll be crucial. So, people really in the past would not have had to have debated this. Christians would not have debated this, or at least not this much. On the other hand, a simple reading of Scripture is going to show many more passages where God is speaking or acting in relation to time in ways that look an awful lot like he's inside of time. So, a lot of parallels with the open theism thing that we talked about a couple weeks ago as well. But if we remember two things, and I'm going to put these two things on the board. Remember these two things. Number one, the avenue of phenomenological speech. Or the phenomenon of phenomena. Oh boy, talk about one that I have to shut up and just concentrate on writing. Phenomenological. There we go. Speech, which includes anthropomorphic speech, but is not exclusive to it. So God doesn't just compare himself to a man and thinking and looking and approaching and drawing near. He also compares himself to forces of nature as well. So just general category, phenomenological speech. Remember that. Second thing, more importantly to remember that we've talked about, is the distinction between God's essence and his manifestation. So let's put that above and below the line as well in orange. So, above the line, the essence of God. What God is in himself, clearly, is not extra-referential. Otherwise, he's not the first cause. In other words, his essence is not his essence because of something outside of himself. Okay? And then below the line, manifestations. The manifestations of his essence. You get that? You got the key to the whole thing. You'll start to see the objections and you'll realize how simplistic the objections are in light of this. If you don't have this, the objections will look extremely sophisticated and tie you in knots. And you'll follow them around in the sands and try to answer them that, on their terms. But if you understand this and keep this in eternity and this in time, then you'll have the key to the entire puzzle that we're about to set out on the table. So let me approach this in four different parts. The first two in our first session. I'm running out of other colors that will actually show up on the board. I'll do this one in green because I'll write it big enough. First of all, we're just going to ask the question, what is time and eternity? So that's first. How do we define these two concepts, time and eternity? We'll start off simple, defining our terms. Secondly, we're going to look at the forms of the challenge. The challenge to the timelessness of God or the atemporality of God. Forms of the challenge.
These are the objections to the classical doctrine.
That's the first session, those two things. 3 and 4, Lord willing, if we are good on time here, we're going to look at atemporality in two senses. And what I mean by that is not two wonderful alternatives, but a right way of looking at it and a wrong way of looking at it. So, two senses, things we could mean by this timelessness. And then I'm going to make a more direct response or an assessment of the criticisms. That's our fourth section. And all of that is going to be in the second session. Here I'm in this fourth section, in other words, hopefully more airtight logical arguments against the criticism of God's timelessness. So, here's the big idea. If you get nothing else, get this. God made all things, and since time is a thing, God made time, and therefore transcends it. Simple syllogism. God made all things, premise one. Time is a thing, premise two. Conclusion, therefore God made time, and I would say as an implication or a second conclusion, therefore God transcends time. If you create something, you transcend it at least in that sense, as a cause as to an effect. But in this case, clearly, if he's causing all things, then he must transcend it in every sense, because there isn't anything else outside of all things to which he is not transcendent to. So, that's the big idea. That's where we're going. So let's first of all define these two terms, time and eternity, which is not an easy thing. Time is not a simple thing to define. Augustine seemed to view time as the ordering of events in a particular mind. By the way, Bertrand Russell had high praise for Augustine's view on time, calling it very sufficient, and I would call it a surprised compliment. That's why he had high praise for it, and why it's so surprising, because Russell didn't have a whole lot of high praise for any Christian thinker. But at any rate, he felt that Augustine's view of time was pretty admirable. But Augustine thought that it was the ordering of events in a particular finite mind. Let me just do that. Let me just put time, definition, according to Augustine, is the ordering or order of events in a, two key words here, in and finite. Mind is important too, but I don't think anybody will disagree with that per se. If you get what the words in and finite mean here, game over. Because what's going to happen here is that the subjective element of time is going to be treated as a non-object. Okay, so we always make the distinction between the subject and object, the knower and the thing known. It just so happens, that can be confusing, because the knower is also a thing. If I can speak about a knower, well then a knower is one of the things known. And therefore, not all objective things are subjective things, but all subjective things are objective things. My dreams, impressions, even errors are things. They're objects. So, hold on to that. You'll see why it comes into play a little bit later on. This view of Augustine, this definition, agrees with the majority report today that sees it as subjective. But there's a difference between what Augustine meant and what the modern subjectivist means. Because today, each subjective point, let's just do it this way first, about subjective things. Each subjective point, in other words, a perspective on the space-time continuum, that's the way a modern person would say it, each subjective point would, in addition to being a subject, would also either be an object, in other words, a thing with a nature, or else nothing at all. So let's get that under our head. By a subject, so this is that subject here. It's a perspectival thing, this event. Now, it also has to be an object here. So that's the rational way to look at it. So, this is what you mean. You either mean that this subjective thing is also an object that can be known, a thing with a nature, or else, nothing at all. It's either a something or a nothing. Okay, that's what I mean by object. Something, anything, a thing with a nature. So, for Augustine, the proposition that time was subjective only meant that it was a finite point in the human subject. But for the modern person, you'd say the same thing. But for the modern, that time is subjective tends to mean that it is not. Now, they don't trace out the implications of what they're saying there. But if you see, to someone who suspects that nature is all there is, subjective things turn out to be less and less like things. They turn out to be less and less like objects. The subjective tends to mean the non-existent, the fairy tale, the unicorn, the impression, the valuation. How odd, then, for the latter, the subjective, to be the basis on which to say that an eternal being must be subject to an it when that it is not. Okay? So, in the modern mood, you're going to see the subjective, the point, turned into a nothing. And in this same modern mood, you're going to see that if God is going to operate down here, then he has to know this not a thing. Hold that under your hat. They're so confused at this foundational level, and by not thinking about it, they're going to build a very sophisticated house that looks very impressive. But we will get to that. But the subjective in modern thought tends to mean non-existent. It tends to be something less and less real, less subjective. Now, mercifully, that's typical of the modern theologian. The modern scientist, on the other hand, is going to equate time to space, at least to a point on the continuum, the space-time continuum, which to him is the only thing that is real. And this is actually closer to Augustine ontologically. One of the interesting ironies of modern thought is how much oftentimes the modern atheist talks a lot more like a Christian than Christians in the church do. It's because of this treatment of reality as real, this kind of residue realism that's in the modern mind. But this idea is actually closer to Augustine ontologically. It's just stripped of its being real in the consciousness. The modern mind doesn't know what to do with consciousness. But if we recognize the relationship between time and the finite mind, then time must belong to finitude. So both the modernist and Augustine are going to say that time is relative. Time, in other words, not real, relative to a subject or a point or a perspective on the, modernist would say, on the space-time continuum, Augustine would emphasize in the consciousness. Not necessarily conflicting ideas, but the modernist thinks so. Now, it's precisely this careful definition of time that prevents the whole rabbit trail of the contemporary philosopher of religion. So if time is a finite object, so notice that, it's a finite object, then it can in principle be known. And if time is subjectively known, in other words, known by the subject, by the observer, that particular perspective, then the object that it is, in other words, it's also an object, in addition to being a subject, it's an object. The object that it is will be known from a unique point within finitude. And if we take both this objective and this subjective aspect of time into account, we'll have a groundwork for seeing what the new philosophers seemingly can't. So, simple definition of time, it's actually very sophisticated, but in a concise, it's the ordering of events in a finite mind. But you have to mean by that, it's an objective thing. You can't mean it's nothing at all. Because then what you mean is that it is an ordering of events, or it is an event, let's just say that, it's an event and not an event at the same time and in the same relationship. Well, that's a violation of the law of non-contradiction. So in order to have a coherent definition of time, so in other words, I haven't defended this definition of time yet. I haven't seen, this is why this definition of time is true. All I'm doing right now is saying, it at least has to be logically consistent. Let's at least start with that. And if what you mean is that it is an ordering of events in a finite mind, and that it's a subjective thing, meaning not really a thing at all, well, that's just another way of saying that it is a thing in the finite mind, and not a thing at all, at the same time and in the same relationship. That is incoherent, babbling nonsense. So, we're going to stick with that. Let's go with eternity. Now, eternity may refer to an everlasting state, in other words, a superlative degree of time. I'm going to argue that's not good enough. That's not what people have meant by eternity in the past. So, but people do use that idea. It's an everlasting state. I believe it is an everlasting state, but I don't mean a superlative degree of time. Because that would make the primary meaning of eternity really a kind of subset of the meaning of time. You see that? In fact, in that definition, an everlasting state meaning a superlative degree of time, even if it's the whole collection of time units, that would mean that eternity is a time, a particular time. Okay, so that would make eternity a subsection of time. That would make time preeminent over eternity. It would make eternity caused by time in some way. Now, it's fine to speak of the believers dwelling in the eternal state forevermore as eternity future. But this endless duration of temporal units or successive events is not the primary import that theologians and philosophers in the classical era have given to this concept. Let me give you now from shifting from Augustine to Boethius, who offered this more basic definition. He said this: eternity, then, is the complete... Well, when I say basic, I don't mean easy. I just mean this is what people have meant by it in the classical era. Eternity, then, is the complete possession. Notice, not procession. It's the complete possession all at once of illimitable life. By the way, when he says at once, contemporary philosophers would needle at that and say, ha, it's still a subset of time. But ignore that for a second. He's speaking metaphorically. Eternity is the complete possession all at once of illimitable life. Therefore, whatever includes and possesses the whole fullness of illimitable life at once and is such that nothing future is absent from it and nothing past has flowed away, this is rightly judged to be eternal. And of this, it is necessary both that being in full possession of itself, it be always present to itself, and that it have the infinity of mobile time present to it. So you notice Boethius is including both immutability and omniscience in eternity. So in other words, in order to be eternal, that being must be unchanging. Because, see, if it's not unchanging, then there has been a cause to it. Okay? And likewise, if everything is not present to it, known by it, and we never did get to the blue marble proof, but the first cause, one of the things I did in there, I've done it a bunch of times in these philosophy classes, is that the first cause cannot have caused something else as a result of a cause outside of itself, that it's not the first cause. And so this first being has to be omniscient, has to have all knowledge, and has to prefer what this cause is versus an other alternative. Otherwise, there's some action as an accident, as a prior cause, and then that thing is not the first cause. So the first cause has to be omniscient. And we can tackle that a little bit more, but Boethius is just assuming that immutability and omniscience are necessary conditions of eternity. So obviously by eternity, he means a self-subsisting, unified being that can't be added to or taken away from. Otherwise, it would contradict the meaning of that state. The whole life of God is in view here when we speak of the difference between time and eternity. For the essence of God, there is nothing that could ever change. To speak of God experiencing time instantly begs a follow-up question. What do you mean by experience? Does the meaning, because I would argue, but under his definition of eternity, yes, he has to experience time. If you mean he knows it, and has it present too, and he has control of it. But if what you mean is he has to become an experience in the way that we do, then there's a whole lot of things in the way that we do that you're now stuffing into that definition. So, does the meaning of experience mean to know, in our objective sense here, all the things in time, all that there is, or does it mean to experience in a finite subjective sense, of which finite objective knowledge is a part? Failure to see the relevance of this question, or failure to think about it at all, ensures all of these irrational rabbit trails that we're forced to address here in this whole week. Now, of course, there's a lot of biblical passages that refer to God as preceding all creation, so before nests, or as being everlasting, so you have that idea of a succession of events that just goes on this way and this way forever. So Psalm 92 or Psalm 102:25 talks about him being changeless, in ages past, you laid the foundations of the earth, the heavens are the work of your hand, and then it talks about the universe rolling away and fading away like a garment, but you are unchanged. So it links immutability in Psalm 102:25 with everlastingness. But it doesn't use the word united and eternal and stuff like that, and so that's what philosophers look at. Well, it means the same thing. But the critic of a God beyond time is going to say that these texts stop short of making time a created thing or of demanding that everlasting mean the same thing as philosophers have meant by eternal. In other words, they're saying unless these verses talk like the philosophers do about it, we can't allow what the philosophers mean by it. That's pretty arbitrary, and I would ask you, where's that in Scripture? Okay, so it's sort of a selective hyper-inductivism. Now, if we say that God is before all things, then we may still mean that He is before in sense of time. So, before is a time, and therefore, so long as God is positioned in relation to a time, then He is at another, or in another time. So that's what the critics are looking at. Even if you say that He is before all time, He's there, not there. So there's still a there-ness. You do the same thing with space. And some critics do. But as a matter of fact, the Bible does clearly teach that God is unchanging, and that implies that He has always been unchanging. Malachi 3:6, I, the Lord, do not change. James 1:17 talks about Him being without change, without shifting shadow, due to change, stuff like that. So divine eternity implies a changeless state of being and knowing. So the Scripture does use the language that Boethius means, even if it didn't use the exact order of words that he used. Okay? So what are the challenges to this idea? Hopefully you understand that this is the idea that the church has always held. Now, that doesn't prove that it's right, but I do like to point that out, because one of the favorite things to do today, at least in the last 30 years, is to start suggesting that these pagan intrusions came sometimes later as the result of some project in the 12th century or the 16th century and things like that, and that just simply isn't true. So let's cover the four philosophical challenges to the classical doctrine of divine atemporality. By the way, atemporal simply means above, beyond. It can mean most literally without time, but that can be misleading because again they'll say, aha, without time he can't be related to time. Okay, that's not what it means. It just means that he is not bound by time. His relationship to time is not bound to time. He is atemporal. He transcends the temporal. So, four challenges to this doctrine have been offered within the most recent philosophy of religion. These have to do with the problems, when I say recent, I mean the last 30 years mostly. These have to do with the problems of, sorry, let me write this out on the board. These are my summary of the criticisms, these four things. Number one, what are called indexical properties. I'll just put indexicals. Relational attributions. We'll get to what all that means. Secondly, simultaneity, if I said that right. Yeah. Sometimes I start talking and I don't... Yeah, there's a word you don't use every day, but just simultaneousness, simultaneous withness. I'm just going to invent words, and that's what I mean by it. Two things simultaneous to each other. Of temporal events with the whole of eternity. So there, simultaneous is not simply referring to this or that, though that's going to be part of it. But the problem is, so they say, is that if it's simultaneous with this, there's a simultaneousness. That's two nesses. No. There's a simultaneity. That's why they invented that word. You see that? Simultaneity from this to this. From this above the line to this below the line. And there again, God would be in time. Thirdly, a trans-simultaneous being is still his own event or presence. But the third one's interesting because it's going to be those who are dealing with this, but they're going to bring that up above the line and they're going to attack the coherence. The third one's really complicated. I don't even know how to say it because the two people, they co-authored these essays, Stump and Kretzmann. Once they get going, you almost want to say to them, well, just agree with the classical definition. In other words, they're going to deny the idea that God has to be succession of events, but they're going to make eternity equal something they call duration, everlasting duration. Here's how I'm going to put this third one. I don't even know how to describe it. So we'll get to it when we get to it. But I'll just draw an arrow from 2 to 3. So in other words, it's going to be that they're recognizing the answer to this, and they still, for some reason, want to define God's atemporality in a way that's not really atemporal. But we're going to see that that is motivated, so I'm going to draw an arrow up from 4 to 3, by a popular objection, namely, in other words, it's one that even non-philosophers hold, if God is timeless, then he can't relate to those in time. So for 4, I'm just going to put that old thing that we already looked at, the transcendence, transcendence, incompatible with the immanence. And in this case, it's just a subset of that problem. Eternity, if it is transcendent to time, cannot relate to time. And at the end of all of these, I'm going to say, do you want to give an argument for that? What do you mean, 30 years worth of papers? Okay, but there's no argument in it. You're claiming that they are not compatible with each other, but you're not at any point showing in what sense. You're trying to, but it never really gets around to say it. So the burden of proof is never satisfied. I hate to make it that simple, but I don't hate to make that. I'm not going to be apologizing for dismantling these objections in the short space that I'm going to, because these are all good examples of what I would call the complexification of the simple error. In other words, they're going to make some simple errors. So I drew that simple chart at the beginning. They're going to make some simple errors up front, and they're going to, with great sophistication and intellect, I'm not going to be criticizing the workings of their intellect, but this is what intellectuals do. They make a simple mistake, as Aristotle said, if you don't get the first things right, you're liable to make errors all the way through. So your first principles of deduction are important. If you make an error there, one little decimal place off and you'll overshoot the moon by a million miles. Okay? It's the same concept here. So, these things, in my opinion, should be dissected in a very concise way. But I don't want to dismiss scholarly books. I don't have it right in front of me. I want a good book by Paul Helm called Eternal God. It was written in 1988, which obviously is standing against the views that are held by William Lane Craig. And Craig was respectful in his, what do they call that? Not a rebuttal, but a critique of the book, I guess you could say. He was respectful of the book, receiving the book, but it was clear that he did not find the book convincing. So there's a place for books like that, like Paul Helm's book, dealing with all of these different objections. That's called Eternal God. It's originally written in 1988, but it's a really nice new edition that came out in 2010, Oxford University Press, and I recommend that to you. It's not too hard to read. It takes a really complex issue, and it's pretty readable. It's big, though, so you have to get yourself a cabin and some caffeine and hang in there. But I didn't, but I want to. I think it's Helm, Craig, and or somebody like that. Yeah. 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 And Wolterstorff, his main problem is the indexicals, like Plantinga. Him and Plantinga are two peas in a pod when it comes to that stuff. But anyway, I think, you know, here's the deal. Here's why the philosopher shepherd has to exist, in my opinion. Most people have no time to read such books, but they've got plenty of time to overhear the rumored version of some very complex, critical intrusion into the faith. It's the reason socialism does so well on television. It takes 2 seconds to say, he's going to take something away from grandma. It takes a long time in Independence Hall to pull together the great books of the Western society and say, a republic, man, if you can keep it. What do you mean, Ben Franklin? Well, you'd have to... We didn't have C-SPAN in there, and so you have to read, and eventually we'll talk, and truth doesn't play well to a soundbite culture. Nevertheless, truth is still true. So it is the task of the philosopher shepherd to come in and tackle some of these things in a concise way, risking the fact that I'm going to miss a few ends, I'm going to assume some language that you're not going to have, or vice versa, and that's a risk I'm willing to take. So you've got to start somewhere. So let's tackle these 4 objections. Number 1, this problem of indexicals. We've brushed up against this notion of indexical properties when we're reviewing Plantinga's assault on divine simplicity. An indexical property is the linguistic meaning of words that, given a different content, would mean something different in a different context. Okay, so words like he or she, even. Which he? Him. Okay, him. And so, you know, 2 seconds later, it means something else, or a different page, or somebody that didn't see your finger point that way. Okay? So the sense of the word doesn't necessarily have a fixed reference in that sense. Walter Storff, we mentioned him, tends to agree with planning on such things. He argues this very way against timelessness. So among indexicals that are relevant to this discussion, you've got words like yesterday, now, then. I mentioned one more before. Oh, present too. Stuff like that. These all really beg the questions. So, philosophers, you just want to burn. Yeah, well, anyway. Indexicals. You don't have to invent this big word. Just, it's a word that begs the question. What do you mean by that? I mean that. That's one of those words. What do you mean by that? Point. Okay. Everybody does that all the time. It's not a big deal. I'm glad philosophers, you need philosophers to talk about it. What you don't need is them to hide behind smoke-filled doors and erect this language that's going to make this thing that all humans do all the time into some mystical thing. Okay? So even words like it is, which is ontological in character, these ones, yesterday, now, then, stuff like that, are temporal in character. And it's objected that God must not use these expressions of himself if he is truly timeless. But in fact, he does use them in relation to himself as he interacts with his people throughout Scripture. So, it's one of those moments that if you just come back to this chart here, you'll see what's going on here. So notice in that complaint how expressions, see manifestation below the line, how expressions have been smuggled into the already ill-defined concept of knowledge. We might ask whether or not a being with no lips or voice box must express to himself in order to know in himself. In other words, it's already obviously figurative language when you speak about expression. A moment's thought will reveal this to be a red herring, albeit with a very weak scent. So let's say it again about this chart. There's a distinction between God in himself and God manifest. The aforementioned expressions, these indexical properties, belong to the manifestations of God and not to the eternal essence of God. We've already shown that all language, indexical or otherwise, is analogical. That is officially no longer a problem. You just have to work off of this chart because all language has that characteristic. Another philosopher draws a sharp distinction between the statements, "It is raining now," let me write these on the board, and "It is raining on Monday, 23rd of July, 1984. So, do I want to do this on the chart below and above the line? I think I do. Yes, I do. Below the line, I'm going to write, now I'm cheating. This philosopher in his book did not do this. So am I cheating or am I correcting him? Well, I'm preemptively correcting him by putting it on this chart as he should have done, and he would have immediately said, huh. Now, it is raining, and here's the indexical, now. By the way, it is can function in that way too. You see that? It is rather than it was, which I'd still ask you, was when? But still, you see what's happening here? There's this regress of, what do you mean? The philosopher comes in with his robe and confuses the heck out of anybody when all he really should say is indexical is one of those things that you do every day when you say, what do you mean? Here, there, when, then, clock, that, this, you mean him, that guy? It's not hard. It is raining. Now, above the line, it is raining on Monday, the 23rd of July, 1984. Why is that above the line? I'll throw that at you right away. Why am I putting that above the line in eternity? Anybody who's ever said that has been in time. As far as we know. But let's just put it this way. A whole lot of people in time have said it. Or something like it. Okay? So why am I putting that above the line? You know, you could put the word was here. It was raining. However, that's is or was. Pick your, you know, it's misleading. Because both have this implication of presentness, pastness. Or it will be. Take your pick. The isness of it, though, has an ontological character. In other words, Epistemology, before epistemology was epistemology, was ontological. The question was, how do we know that we know? In other words, what constitutes objective knowledge? It wasn't, how'd you come to know that? So go back to my last class and the philosophical apologetics class, and I talk about how epistemology eroded from the beginning, from an objective question to a subjective question. So this whole question of indexicals is locked up into this subjective shift in our civilization. It's not a meaningless question. It is a straw man question on this shift from objective to subjective thinking. Both are propositions of which the two senses, two apparently different meanings, correspond objectively to the identical referent. Now, if you come along and say, no, I meant July 24th. Okay, great, then you're talking about two different states of affairs. The way you clear that up is to say, what do you mean? But you're not talking about two irreconcilable things. These two things are, in this sense, subjective. The referent, which is what this is attempting to drive at more clearly, more articulately than this, there's a third thing here, namely the object, which this is just more articulate at drawing out, whether it's right or wrong. The objectivity of it depends upon the object, okay? Not the subjective point in time. So, the question in objective knowledge is identity between thought and object. Thought and the thing thought about. Which identity is analogical? The issue is not identity of one analogy to another analogy. So this philosopher is fixating on one analogy, which is subjective, versus another analogy, which is subjective. So, when you use analogical speech or thought, it's always analogical all the time. And that analogy will be subjective in comparison to the thing that is thought about or known. Okay? So this person is treating the object of eternity versus time in these propositions, in these indexical properties, as if they are the last stop, as if they are the object of comparison. Okay, that follows the shift towards subjective thought in our inferior thought stream in Western civilization. God knows that the big hand on the clock is pointing at the three in the totality of all of the big hand's relationships to everything else in infinity. So to say he knows it completely means he knows that all of those things in relation to that are true. We in the room that are with the big hand, pointing at the three, usually stop short of the fact that it is pointing at the three. In other words, we have a lot less knowledge. Now, see, what's happening here is we're calling knowledge of time. You see, here's my punchline. Here's why it matters. When we say knowledge of time, what we tend to mean is something less like knowledge than what I just said God knows about the hand pointing at the three. In other words, by knowledge of time, we tend to mean less knowledge of time. Do you see the card trick? By knowledge of time, in the subjective shift, we start to, I erased the thing at the beginning, which I wanted to keep up there and I forgot. In this subjective shift, we tend to make subjective things less like an object. Okay? I don't even remember how I drew it, so I can't just point you back to it. But what's happening here, not intentionally and maniacally and stuff like that, just incompetently, we are starting to mean, by knowledge of time, we're starting to mean something that is directly opposed to a sane, normal, rational definition of knowledge of a thing. We tend to mean the perspective, the analogy, the representation, the point of the finite observer, which is the opposite of the actual thing outside of the observer. So to call the latter, namely the person in the room pointing at the three and usually not at much else, to call the latter the essence of knowing it, and then after that to conform our definition of timeless knowledge to that isn't simply misguided. It's to approach the question infinitely backwards. I'll give you a little thought experiment. Make it simple. If you say that it's 6 o'clock, and that it can only be known when it is 6 o'clock. Now, why are you doing that, by the way? Let's just say you're one of the critics that says God, in order to be timeless, can't know that it's 6 o'clock. That's usually one of the examples that's used. So, if you say it is 6 o'clock, can only be known when it is 6 o'clock, then we might reply as a class, which 6 o'clock? If you say the one happening right now, again, more indexicals happening, we may reply again. Do you mean the one right now on the other side of the globe? So we're being annoying, but for a point. If you insist, of course not, it means this 6 o'clock that you can see symbolized by that clock right there. I may point to it and say, ah, you're too slow. A minute has gone by with all this arguing. It's 6:01. Well, you may want to fight on and say, very well, it's 6:01 in Boise on October 25th, 2011. Now, let's see you try to get out of that one. Since we're in a philosophy class, we will try. We will try to be annoying, and so we will say, what about for that person on the other side of the world? Is it 6:01 in Boise on this date for him? And since you're not a relativistic sort, so you think, you may say, of course it is. He doesn't get to make the time here to be different just because it's different time there. We'll continue to be annoying by saying, so you're saying that if it's 6:01 in Boise, then it being 6:01 in Boise does not in any sense depend upon the experience of the person in China or in Boise. That's right, you fire back, suspecting us to be the relativists here. And then having laid our trap, we're going to say, okay, so from what you're saying, if I know that it is 6:01 in Boise, and as I point my hand to the clock now showing that it's 6:03, just to make the point a little bit more confidently, this knowledge that I have is of the state of affairs as it is in itself and not in any one finite mind's vantage point of that state of affairs. To which you'll hopefully by that time come off your ledge and say, yeah, I think so, if I understand what you're saying. And to conclude, we add this. There are really two classes of states of affairs here. On the one hand, there are the knowers who are knowing of time in this case, and in all the various ways that they know, perspectives. On the other hand, there is the time that is known, which is not the same thing as the other subjective elements of the finite knower's knowing. If I stand up to get a better view, in order to know something, my feet do not, for that reason, know something. My standing, in other words, does not become a part of my knowing. Bring it back to the problem. In one more way, we can see how the demand for God to know time only by sharing in our experience is a demand for us to be either having him know less or to be doing something that is not knowledge. So what's happening here is a category mistake. What has happened here is that an entire philosophical conundrum has been built on top of a much more foundational shift in what constitutes objective knowledge. At any rate, Paul Helm exposes another pretty inconvenient implication by reductio ad absurdum. In other words, he assumes the premises and he argues it out to show you the absurdity of trying to work it out to its logical conclusions. And he uses the parallel case of omniscience as such. So, this is what Helm says. If an omniscient being has to be me now in order to know the truth of the true utterance, I am married, and if he has to be you now in order to know the truth of your utterance, I am married, then he has to be both me and you now. In other words, if A is equal to B and B is equal to C, then A is also equal to C. So he says, it follows from the principle of the transitivity, which is what I just said, of identity, that I now am identical with you now, since some omniscient being is now identical with us both. Hence, we are both identical with each other and with God. That is, we are both God. This is a problem. This is a problem, and we're going to continue to dig into it. Now, if that's too drastic of a consideration, you might stay simple and realize that if to know something demanded that we know it as someone else knows it, identically, then either no one knows anything which can be communicated from one person to another, because nobody's somebody else, or else everyone is everyone else with whom it may be communicated. In other words, this assumption logically leads us either to total agnosticism, in which you can't know anything because you're not identical to somebody else's experience, that's what you mean by knowledge, or else total monism, that every point is every other point, so that there's no differentiation. That is a huge dilemma. But this whole track of thinking here to reduce eternity to, and saying knowledge, in this case eternal knowledge of something, this being above the line, this being the case, ontologically, in other words, If it is true, and I've used this before, I have no idea how many people, well, it's two erasers. If it is true that there are three erasers on that thing at 866, blah, 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 and that's the referent, not just the sense of it, then that cannot not be true at the same time and in the same relationship. Time? What about at 903? Yeah, 903. Okay, well, again, this is A and that's B. It's a separate state of affairs. If this sense is about the reference of this state of affairs, then it is eternally true or else not true at all. Now, we work that out and you can make an argument for an eternal mind, but the point right now is to say, if you reduce objective knowledge to a subjective state, you're no longer talking about knowledge at all. You're talking about a lack of knowledge or something that doesn't have anything to do with knowledge. That's the first indexical. I erased it. The second problem, the second objection, much shorter, just summarize it. Anthony Kenny, another philosopher, stumbles over the simultaneity of an event today and one from the ancient world. So, for example, something happening, something he's doing in his living room, and I think Nero burning Rome was the example he used. So anyway, so we have two events in time, one obviously in this case, 2,000 years before another. So, you have a non-simultaneity there. However, if God is to know it, then he must be simultaneous with it. But if he is simultaneous with all things that he knows, and if he knows all things, then God, and his, in other words, in his knowing apparatus, is simultaneous with all things. Now remember, if A is equal to B, and B is equal to C, then A is equal to C. Therefore, conclusion, God is simultaneously with everything, and therefore everything is simultaneous with everything else. But again, we've already said that that's not what knowledge means. So simultaneous is just another concept that makes the same error. Supposing the word simultaneous is already loaded with the conclusion that all three are going on at the same time, which they are. That's what simultaneous means. So you're already assuming in that eternal knowledge is simultaneous to prove the point. In other words, we have the fallacy of circular reasoning. For the temporal status of atemporality, in other words, whether it's a coherent concept, is exactly what we're arguing about. You can't load that into your first premise in order to prove it. That is the fallacy of circular reasoning. So that particular approach can be dumped. Third, once all that is admitted, a further objection can be leveled, which most notably came in the form of Eleanor Stump and Norman Kretzmann's essay on eternity, I think it was in 1981. And the crux of it was that no being can be one event. That's kind of what Boethius was defining as the eternality of God. Or that if there could be, such a being can't be related to anything else. Notice that relationship per se is now being defined as simultaneity. So, that's what I mean by that second one going to the third one. So, I'll put relationship on the lines, because the whole debate here is whether or not such a being can relate to time if he is timeless. So relationship here, notice, is now being equated. In other words, I'm going to make quick work of this. I am showing up front that the fallacy of equivocation is going on here. Prior to that, Kenny was guilty of the fallacy of circular reasoning. Stump and Kretzmann will be guilty of the fallacy of equivocation here, where terms take on different means as they go. Relationship, as such, is going to be equated to simultaneity. And since we've already dismissed that, that is circular reasoning, this will fall as well. We've already demonstrated that insisting that the timeless God exists simultaneous with a temporal event is circular. It follows from that that the same circle has imposed itself here under the guise of relatability. Why can a timeless being not relate to a temporal event? We have to ask them. Well, the implicit answer is that the only way that one thing, one object, can relate to another thing or object is for the two to be simultaneous to each other. You see that? In this definition, this analytical relationship between relationship and simultaneity, this equation of the two, in other words, the only thing that, the only reason how, what am I saying? The only way, there you go, the only way that one thing can be related to another thing is for them to be simultaneous to each other. But that's already untrue about every single temporal thing. In fact, every single simultaneous thing, even, so for example, the existence of this piece of chalk and another piece of chalk, what do you mean by existence of a piece of chalk? One's disintegrating, one's into the other's disintegrating, probably at a different rate, at a different point in time, time's relative on the space-time continuum. In other words, it's a very unsophisticated definition of simultaneity to begin with. Every other point of time is relative to the location of consciousness on the space-time continuum. In other words, whether you take Augustine's view of consciousness being that point, or whether you take a modern physicist talking about points on the space-time continuum as the point of temporality, in either case, no single thing is ever exactly simultaneous with another single thing. So everything that is an event is related to every other thing, not in time, but in eternity. What relates things, by the way, the old thinkers understood. You remember The Matrix, the second episode when love was opposed to logic? Remember the architect when he comes into the room? That's just typical postmodernism. But the modern world was already going in that direction. The old thinkers, when they said it's all about relationship, would have meant logical relationship. In other words, how something goes together with another thing. Now we think that things going together with other things is a product of time. That's atheism. That's not theism. That's not thinking like a theist. A theist thinks from the top down. A theist thinks from God to the world. A theist thinks from truth to its instances, from universals to particulars. In fact, nothing natural or an event or an effect is exactly simultaneous with anything else. So their rationale backfires into infinity. Fourthly, there's the popular objection. This is really what motivates them, even. The popular objection, no different than the supposed tension between transcendence and immanence that we've already looked at. If God is beyond time, then the idea is that he's remote or aloof or indifferent toward the temporal affairs of real people. Notice, real people means dirt. Okay, personhood, last time I checked in the Christian worldview, meant spiritual. So, just notice that. There's always an atheistic shift behind all of these different innovations in the Christian worldview. And the idea here, if we're looking for real personhood down here, changeability, is we are to that degree, to the degree that God's up there, we're down here, to the degree that the godness of God is up there first, not related to this, to that degree we are prisoners of time. To that degree we are apart from God. And we've already dealt with that in transcendence and immanence, how they have to go together to mean even themselves. This Stump-Kretzmann view of e-duration that they were talking, in other words, one of those sort of cheaper, it's allowable in biblical language and in Christian language to talk about eternity, future, God is it from everlasting to everlasting, succession of moments. That's fine. God does not mind, obviously, condescending to our language so we can understand. But God wasn't trying to communicate in Psalm 102:5 about this everlastingness that, talking about creation over here, you're really weak and you're withering away, whereas I'm over here. Look at my shoes. That has nothing to do with what he was saying. That's poetic language to communicate it in a simple way so that we can understand it. But he's not saying that everlasting is a duration of these units. I just have more units than you, King of the Hill. That's not the idea. Okay, so this idea of e-duration was defended against charges that it implies division or succession in God. So some of these contemporary philosophers did want to maintain that God does not experience succession of events or division in his attributes. Yet if some philosophers want to maintain these classical attributes, it's difficult to see why any new view of atemporality is necessary. One suspects that it is this old suspicion, this popular suspicion that divine timelessness, purely and simply, eliminates the relatability of God in time to creatures in time. So with that long first session, let me stop there.